call the February 12th, 2008 committee meeting of the House Workforce and Economic Development Committee to order. Hello to everyone. And I would like to open a informational meeting on the pipeline, the workforce pipeline. And first on the list, I would like to call up, please, Audrey Teas and Claire Berger. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you for turning out here early this morning. Please proceed.
Representative Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Claire Berger. I'm the governor's workforce policy advisor. I have been for the last 5 years. This particular report we're going to be talking about today, or rather, I think Audrey is going to be talking mainly about, was commissioned by the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which is the advisory board to Governor Kulongowski on workforce matters. To better understand the future economy of the state and forecast workforce needs associated with the drivers of the economy. So this particular report is heavily based in economic related information and what we think or hope may be happening in the state in terms of the economic drivers. The report results will be used along with the OWIV State Strategic Plan, which is winning in the global marketplace. I believe we have copies over there on the table. The executive staff to the OWIV, very quiet, is sitting in back of me for any other questions regarding that report. We're going to be using both of these documents for the development of a strategic investment strategy for workforce development in Oregon. The report is actually presented as a call to action that would be collectively held and implemented by education, workforce, labor, private business, local communities, and economic development. So we see this as something that is a lot of people's responsibility. So without further ado, I'd like to present Audrey Teas, who's the consultant on this project.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, it's a real pleasure to be here. This morning is a lot about, as Claire said, sort of the economic future of the state. But I'd like to preface this by saying one thing that's, I think, unique about this particular report is that it really looks at the intersection of economic development, education, and workforce development. So whereas there have been quite a few reports done across the state on each of those, this one really attempts to look at the intersection of those. My company, Key Links, is a Portland-based consulting firm, and the Key Links part is the linking between economic, workforce, and education. I did this project in partnership with Battelle. You may recognize that name. It's an international firm that looks primarily in the technology world, lives in the technology world. And this particular quote really kind of captures what's happening in terms of the policy arena for states. Over the past decade, I think it's become clearer and clearer that states need to chart a very strategic course for themselves so that they can differentiate themselves and specialize themselves not only among the states but in the global economy. The goal is really, in the last sentence, to sort of overwhelm the competition by being the pioneer, the champion, or the only player. And that really requires some very strategic thinking. If you look at all of the studies that are out there, and we looked at many, both across the country, international, and within Oregon, the bottom line is that it's really becoming the technology-based innovation that's driving change, and combining that with an aggressive efforts to develop the agile, knowledge-based workers that are needed to really prime that and continue that innovation. That's really the recipe for economic competitiveness. So what you see happening across the country and across the world is really positioning for that specialized focus. The research questions that we were asked to address were really intended to provide a strategic framework for Oregon in terms of a future-oriented workforce investment strategy. How might the state begin to really look strategically? There are so many good things going on in Oregon, but how might the state look strategically over the next 2 to 5 years to really key itself up for that that specialized position in the global economy? So the key questions we were asked to address were, what might be the future drivers? What workers with what skills will be needed? What capacity does Oregon now have? What are the major gaps that need to be addressed, and what should we do? Now, the focus of this particular research was on the traded sectors. Because we were asked to look at the drivers of the future economy, we recognize that all employers are important to the economy. But I have read your report of your deliberations over the past year, so I know that you're keenly aware that the traded sectors in Oregon, those sectors that basically export their goods and services and therefore bring wealth into the state, are especially critical. And so our focus is on those. What you'll see as I go through the findings is that many of those findings, though, do generalize to other parts of the economy. And many of the skills needed for workers in the traded sectors, of course, apply much more broadly across. So if you create a system to feed the traded sectors, there will be many other ripple effects of benefits across the economy. This was a fairly unique approach. Many studies that look at these sorts of issues really focus primarily on industry employment data. How many workers, what are the numbers, what's the quantifiable kind of information. So you get that sort of on the workforce side. And then there are studies that look at technology competencies within the economy. What are the technology drivers, that critical mass of know-how that's really propelling the current economy and likely to propel the future economy? What we really did in this study was bring the two of them together, which required us to do some sort of out-of-the-box sorts of thinking, because, at least based on our scan, no one's really taken quite this approach before. And as Duncan Wise, who heard this presentation when I did it before the Board of Ed a few weeks ago, said, finally, someone has made the connection for us between all the work we've been doing with clusters and traded sectors and all the work that's been going on in terms of data analysis around employment projections and high-demand occupations. So that's what's a little different about our approach. Basically, what we did was we started with a look at the current economy to try to understand better within the traded sectors what were those technology drivers, both the technology development, the innovation through patent analysis, et cetera, but also what are the key technology deployers, because many Oregon's economy, there are many traditional industries like metals and food and wood that don't so much play in the technology development arena, but are critical in terms of the deployment of technology in the workplace. We did an analysis of those. We worked very closely with OED and Graham Slater's shop to look at the state occupational forecasts and to understand the employment side. But we also wanted to get beyond the numbers. So working again through the Oregon Business Plan and many of the cluster organizations and trade associations in the state, we met with all of them and we said, here's what the numbers tell us. Can you help share some ground truth about your experience so that we're sure we understand the trends in your industry and the workforce implications of those? That led us to the identification of workforce needs, and we could have stopped there, but in their wisdom, what the Workforce Board said, what we really need now to do is look at how that aligns with the current capacity within the state to address those needs in the future, what the gaps are, and how we might address those gaps. So briefly, what I'm going to do this morning is answer those five questions. And we start with what might be the drivers of the future economy. It starts very quickly with where things stand now. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I know you've heard it before. Basically, in terms of economic specialization, Oregon has a high employment concentration in the traditional industry drivers of wood, electronics, agriculture, food processing. And from a competitive standpoint, in terms of employment growth rate, Oregon has done extremely well over the past decade. The certain business services and medical products are growing faster than the U.S. Others are growing while the U.S. is declining, and the bottom few that are listed there are slightly declining in Oregon, but at a much slower rate than in the U.S. And if you look at your diagram, I don't know why it is that for some reason when I do this presentation, the pretty little bubble chart that's in your handout on the bottom of page 4 doesn't show up because it's one of my favorites. But if you would just take a minute to look at that picture because it's a very powerful picture. What it shows quickly is that Oregon, this is a picture that most states would die to have. Basically what it is it shows the two axes. The horizontal axis shows, that's basically everything above that 1.2 line represents the concentration of workers. In other words, how much more likely are industries in Oregon to have concentration of workers. So you see at the top of the bubble chart, for example, wood and other forest products. Oregon is, you won't be surprised about this, 3 times more likely than most other states in the country to have wood and forest product work. Okay, so that's the concentration. The other axis to the right of the vertical line is growth rate. So what you see is, for example, transportation equipment and parts is growing at a much faster rate than the rest of the nation. In fact, the recreational vehicle, the concentration of recreational vehicle manufacturing in Oregon is 3 times greater than any other state in the country, and the second fastest growing beyond a group in Indiana. So this is a good picture. In that top right-hand corner, then, those show the stars. The bottom right-hand corner show areas that are not yet specialized, but they're outpacing the nation. And what doesn't show are, on the left-hand bottom, that quadrant in the bottom, groups that are still, they're neither specialized nor growing, but they're doing well, like financial services. And the top right corner quadrant, where nothing shows, is where you're losing against the competition. So this is a very good picture. The question is, how long can it stay this way, given advancing technology, given the aging population, the retirement of many of the skilled workers, and many other external factors that are impacting where Oregon stands? So what we did to get a sense of the capacity was, as I said, we took a scan of the technology development strengths, and we found, I won't go into the detail, that the report, which will be out in several weeks, has gobs and gobs of detail. I really wanted to stay above the detail level here today and give you the big picture. But we found a very robust set of innovation drivers in electronics, in software, in internet services, in metals manufacturing, some strong niche markets in apparel. It's, again, a very strong picture. On the technology deployment side, where you're putting technology to work, again, food processing, wood products, there are some tremendous efforts to deploy technology creatively, and growth and productivity has been positive and outpacing the nation. The bottom line of all this, then, is we looked at, so what are the intersections between the shared markets and the technology drivers? On the left-hand side is Oregon's current list of traded sectors, that top group of 12. And at the bottom are the emerging industries that have been identified by Economic Development and Oregon Inc. and some of the signature research centers. That's a long list. When Michael Porter was here, he said, it's hard to get your head around that many different things going on. What we learned was that when you look at the intersections, those are in fact not discrete groups. They don't function discretely. There's intersections between and among them. And so the listing to the right represents sort of a new way of thinking, a new lens. This is what we call technology and market platforms. These seven areas represent the intersection of the technology and the marketing relationships between and among all of those groups and the emerging industry sectors. So we use that group of seven as our framework for thinking about the workforce implications. So the answer to the first question is, what are the future drivers? We would say that list to the right represents the future drivers of Oregon's economy. When we talked, when we looked at which workers with which skills, again, there is lots and lots of data out there. But to try to relate it in a comprehensive way across all seven of those platforms, we stood back and said, after you look at all the data and all the occupations, what are the major mega groups that impact all of those? Because from a strategic investment point of view, what you want to do is build the workforce base that feeds and supports as many of the different activities within the technology platforms as possible. Okay, so we came up with a scheme that was pretty straightforward, looking at the mega occupational groups around production, computer-related, engineers, and engineering technicians. When you stand back and look at the projected growth openings across the state over the next forecast for the next 10 years, it's significant. It's all positive. The real issue here, though, that this won't surprise you, is in the replacement openings, because the replacement openings will be huge. And if you look in particular at production, which in Oregon is a big part of the workforce base because of the traditional industries that drive many of the technology platforms, the projection is approximately 4,000 annual openings every year between now and 2016. That's a big number. And it's much larger than in many states because of the nature of the economy. So what we attempted to do then was say, well, in the capacity section, we look at how positioned is Oregon to address those quantitative numbers. We did, for each of the seven technology and market platforms, a six-page summary that will be presented in an appendix. It's sort of a what you might want to know about wood, for example, forestry and wood. There's a six-page summary that gives all the data. We looked at market trends. We looked at implications for the workforce. We looked at what specific Oregon workforce issues. And so each one of those has their own profile. What I'm trying to do here this morning is just hit a couple of the high points to cut across all seven of those. And some of those, again, because of the work you've done, won't surprise you. The first, and I'm not going to go at length through this whole list, but the bottom line is the changing nature of work in terms of the product innovation and the rapid shifts and advances in technology are creating a dynamic in the workplace where those already in the workplace are struggling to keep up with advancing technology. So there's a huge need for upgrading the skills of the current workforce. Big issue number one. As more companies adopt high-performance practices and lean manufacturing and promote innovation, you're going to see a need for much more agility and versatility and multi-skilling within the workforce. The narrow occupational classifications that have been in place for literally decades are becoming moot because the focus now is on skills. And there are many occupations emerging that are not even in the employment development's database because they have yet to be classified by the federal government or state government, like health informatics technician. There is no classification that you can look up and say, how many of them do we have? The cross-cutting skills issue at the foundation level, what our analysis shows is that across most of the platforms, and even clean tech, there is a set of cross-cutting skills that impact all workers in all industries, and I'm going to show you those in just a second. In terms of Oregon workforce issues, a huge issue, again, about the preparation of high school graduates for the modern workplace. The whole notion of out-of-state recruitment. We saw many groups, particularly at the high skill end, still relying on out-of-state recruitments because they can't find the talent within the state. And significant skill mismatches that I'm going to highlight in just a second. This is the foundation stuff I mentioned a minute ago. In addition to the real important basic reading, math, et cetera, I did a synthesis of about a dozen national surveys, some of which are, and reports, some of which are credited there. And this is the list that represents the findings of all of those. The first important point is applied skills are critical in the workplace. But the interesting thing on the core workplace side, and I do a lot of work in this arena, is the beginning of shifting. About when the similar studies were done 10 years ago, the news was teamwork, and that was important. And it still is very important. But now you see what's beginning to morph to the top: creativity, innovation, critical thinking, and problem solving. So teamwork is still very important, but there's a new set of drivers around the innovation agenda that we can't ignore. And at the top of the list on the personal management, and I know you hear a lot from employers about the personal management skills associated with work, but that ability to learn quickly and that agility. Again, very interesting.
Audrey, yeah. Were those lists rank ordered?
I did my best. It's fairly informal, but based on my synthesis of all of those, yes.
Yes, okay.
That's me. So now we switch to, so that's a general overview of the workplace piece. Again, there's much more detail in the report about specific skill sets for each of the different areas. But focusing now on the current capacity, what we see in terms of on the employment side is, again, production is very interesting in Oregon because while the rest of the nation, the production declined, Oregon production continues to grow. So it's a very healthy and important part of the economy. Into the technician level, which are that kind of the next rung up, typically associated with an AA level degree, Oregon is highly specialized, 63% greater than the U.S. in terms of that technician level. There aren't many of them, but they're highly specialized. It has a lot to do with the electronics end of the economy. On the computer-related, interesting, employment has rebounded, and out of the sort of dot-com era. You'll see in a minute the mismatch, though, because people don't know that. So the enrollment levels in computer-related programs have fallen dramatically, and it's an issue. And engineering, here's a very important point. I'm not quite sure how to explain this one yet, but while there's been substantial growth in engineering employment at the national level, reflecting this whole movement towards innovation, in Oregon it's been very modest. So the bottom line finding is that in Oregon tends to have a relatively higher concentration of generally lower skill workers than the rest of the country. So then we look at, well, now on the supply side, and this is a very inexact science because the proxy that we used is graduates coming out of the system from national databases, and we're trying to map that set of data against what the projections from employment department are, which is also an exact set of data because there are all sorts of variables. We know that employers can recruit from other sources out of state. We know there's in-migration of skilled workers that we'll add into the mix. So we're talking about trends here, not exact numbers. But the general trend is on the production side, most employers recruit from high school, and the big issue is that they lack the critical foundation skills they need. I worked with the Office of Apprenticeship and learned that industrial apprenticeships, which are different than, there's some overlap with construction, but the industrial trades that really work in the manufacturing plants primarily, we have only 500 enrollees in industrial apprenticeships in this state. It's extremely low, and there are a number of factors I can discuss. And we know that the numbers of graduates from AA and certificate programs, while increasing, is also about 500. So you remember that big 4,000 number? There's a bit of the gap because we see that the supply side is producing about 1,000 roughly, and the high school graduates, where the main source would be, there's a mismatch in skills. So I will be coming back to that issue.
Representative Huffman.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Audrey, are you going to be getting into the whys?
Yes.
Why there's a disconnect? And
yes. Okay. I'll go quickly through this. On the technician side, again, even though we're highly specialized, we're seeing drops in community college graduates since 2003. On the computer side, again, graduate levels down 23% since 2003. And engineering is the different one here, because there's been a lot of work to increase enrollments and graduation, and it's paying in engineering, and it's paying off. So we are seeing an increase on that side. I won't spend much time on this. I know you've dealt with the educational preparedness. Suffice it to say that Oregon has some real challenges in terms of high school completion rates, some college completion rates, current worker training rates. Everything is behind national averages. And there's also the whole issue of changing demographics, which is resulting in a generally lower education level. So you can see how the gaps are beginning to line up. The last capacity issue we looked at was just the infrastructure. And I know, again, you looked at this in your report, and we came to the same conclusion. Oregon has a pretty impressive infrastructure. You've got a focused, traded sector focused. You've got employment training funds for current workers. There's career pathway system. There's an opportunity fund. You've got all the right tools, basically. And I did an alignment with the National Governors Association, set of criteria for what it takes. And a lot of the tools are there, but there's a but. There's a however that I will get to in very shortly. So what are the gaps? There's this large structural gap with this shortfall of between 3,000 and 5,000 workers that are going to need the skill sets. There are multiple issues. Senator Huffman, to your question regarding this, a big one is the lack of knowledge and information for students, guidance counselors, parents, and the general public about the career opportunities in the traded sectors in the state. People just don't know, and there's an image issue that a lot of the careers are still dirty, dangerous, et cetera, when in fact, when I tell parents, do you understand that your son could make $60,000 as a machinist and basically wear a white shirt and work on a computer? They look at me like I'm crazy, because there's just a lack of information and a lot of misinformation. Other states are very aggressive. I was in Pittsburgh recently in a hotel. Within an hour, on their cable and PSAs, there was a story about robotics. There was a story about a career technical school. Some of this is a messaging issue. On the technician level, there is this supply-demand gap. There's just a modest gap, but here's the real crux there. As you saw, the enrollments in apprenticeship, the enrollments in the AA degrees are not high, and they're falling. At the same time, there's a high push for innovation and moving to high-performance workplaces. So as the skill set ratchets up and the supply drops, there's also a big issue in the technician level area. On the engineering side, and we've been working very closely with Bruce Schaefer and the Oregon system around refining these numbers, but our basic conclusion is the output of engineers is now much more available than it was several years ago to support innovation. The issue is the connection between the local universities and the major set of small and mid-sized employers in those platform areas, particularly in the more traditional industries like wood products and food processing. They're adopting an innovation agenda, but they don't have any connections with the university system on applied research. So that's the nature of the disconnect on the engineering side, is how do we pull this together? And then I mentioned the need for more multidisciplinary programs, and I did get some very exciting news from OSHU and OIT around things like embedded systems engineering and geo-informational engineering systems. They're really trying to get at this cross-section of multidisciplinary programs, but they've only just begun. And on the computer-related, the issue here is primarily driven by the fact that with the dot-com bust, everybody assumed that was, quote, dead, and so the enrollments have dropped substantially, while, as we all know, information technology is pervasive across multiple sectors, and so you've got this undersupply phenomenon at work. On the system side, big gaps on the academic and workplace foundation skills for both new and current workers. Just to spend a minute on each of these because they're very important. We still find a fairly stovepipe approach. There's been tremendous gains in collaboration across agencies and at the regional level. You see a lot of change around collaboration. It's really good stuff. But there's still a fundamental stovepipe approach where education's here, workforce is still associated with sort of the federal second chance system, universities are here, economic development is here, and the more progressive states really adopt a systems approach, looking at how all of those systems working in an integrated fashion can support their economic drivers. So that's what you'll see in the recommendations. There's a lot of good pilots in Oregon. Unfortunately, many of them never get to scale, and they're never shared. So good things that happen in regional communities are never adopted statewide as effective practice. There are some issues around funding sources, not just levels, but flexibility of funding, and I can speak to that. Around the incumbent worker training program, for example, is funded with federal workforce training funds, which means that you don't have the flexibility that most states have, which also supplement that with state or lottery money or UI tax offsets to do more creative and innovative things. So you're bound by the federal regulations, which are very restrictive. And then these two points that I raised earlier about the messaging to students, and then the messaging, this last bullet, I really have to, this goes to Claire's point about shared responsibility. There's a whole issue out here, too, to employers about the importance of investing in lifelong learning. And the numbers of employers who are really doing training, much of the training is at the management level. The shift has to be to the frontline worker, which is really where the skill gaps are. So there's messaging across the board. I've made most of these points on the production side. I want to just go to the third bullet. There's a notion that clean tech is somehow off to the side and that it's very different and we have to set up this whole other system. In fact, the skill sets to drive many of the production and technician level jobs in clean tech, like the turbine engines, et cetera, and solar, they're very comparable to all of the other skill sets across many of the other manufacturing sectors. What's beginning to happen in Oregon is there's a recruitment effort for these companies with a sustainability agenda, which is great. But because of these mismatches in supply and demand, you're seeing companies moving in who are literally stealing employees from existing traditional industries because the skill sets are so similar. And we're beginning to see it now already, and it's only going to get worse if there's something not done soon to prime the pipeline on the production and technician worker, because you're going to get this tension. I'm not going to go through all of these slides because I think they're pretty straightforward. What should you do? So this isn't an exhaustive list. I think I picked the 12 high-priority recommendations that we came out with. And on the occupational shortage issue, the first is we have the data. We know the numbers as best anyone can, given the qualifiers that I already mentioned. We've got to get the data out there. It's got to be easily understood by the whole system that these are the high-demand specialty occupations that Oregon needs in the next next year, the year after that. And there's got to be some sort of incentive system for the community colleges and the apprenticeships and the universities to focus on those needs. There's an issue here, of course, about the marketing, because the program structure is in place. It's getting the students in. That's the other component, and I address that under the systems issue. So these are all interrelated. Another interrelated point is bullet number two. I'm now, Mount Hood Community College has a great integrated metals program that they want to offer. They can't find an instructor because the skill set is demanding, but it's a big issue not only for them but for others. So we, with our sort of outside-the-dots thinking, are suggesting no other state has done this, but if you match the retirement of all of these skilled workers that's happening, there's got to be a way to put together some sort of retired skilled workers corps or something where we are targeting that group to say, hey, wouldn't you like to come back into the classroom? And we've got to look at the credentialing issues within the classroom and different models. Maybe it's not one full-time instructor. Maybe it's four people who are doing part-time based on their specialty. But there are some ways, we believe, to address this that no one's really thought of, and I'd love Oregon to be the first state in the country to do that. And then we've got these effective models of work-based learning like internships and co-ops like the MECOP program, but the scale, again, it's not where we need it to be. We need to get many more students out. So this speaks to the business partnership angle. More businesses need to open up their workplaces for young people in high school, community colleges, and university so we get that firsthand applied learning, and the schools need to understand that that is a part of the learning process. It's just in a different place. On the critical skills shortages, these aren't in any priority order, but these are the top 12 things we recommend. As you probably know, there is an essential skills component that deals with many of those foundation skills I emphasized as a part of the new high school diploma requirement. The issue is it's not set to be required for graduation until 12-12, I believe. So our thinking is, while it can't be required for graduation because you have to let eighth graders know what's going to be required and prepare them, there's got to be a way we can ratchet up those requirements even if they're not required for graduation and say immediately, this is a set of skills that employers need and begin to work on them. There is the career technical education, a huge issue, not only around the value of career technical education, the perceived value of career tech in Oregon, but, you know, focusing it and relating it to the technology market platforms. There's already movement in that direction. It just needs to be boosted. And federal money for this area, as I'm sure you all are aware, has continued to decline. Aggressive states have supplemented that with state money and other kinds of sources so that we get that 2+2, the high school juniors and seniors, oriented around these technology platforms and drivers, and we get them into internships, and there's a clear connection to what they need to take at the community college, and that it's okay to do that. That's a big messaging issue, is the only value is not graduating from high school and going to a four-year college. There is value and tremendous need and very much legitimacy in the whole career technical education issue. We've gone far past the dichotomy between the academic here and the old vocational model. The new career tech is very rigorous, has very high standards. It's all driven by what employers need. And in many states, those are the schools that the kids compete to get into. That's not the case in Oregon. And finally, on this set, is the whole issue around science, technology, and engineering at the middle school. You can't wait until the university to introduce this. This has to begin in the middle school. And I just will highlight one. We do some profiles in the report. We call them benchmark profiles to show. We were asked to sort of, well, how is Oregon doing? Just another one for your information on Project Lead the Way. This is a nationally recognized curriculum of project-based learning that deals with math and science. Indiana provided state funding for 350 high schools and middle schools to adopt this curriculum 2 years ago. Five high schools and one college in Oregon have this program because it's individual choice. It is expensive. School systems are struggling. And so, this gets to my systemic issue. On the incumbent worker piece, I already mentioned the Employer Worker Training Fund. Oregon's been very creative, but the source of money is an issue, and this is a huge need. We need to look at training programs in these clean tech areas that have documented needs, such as wind turbine and solar. If I have my numbers correct, the wind turbine program in Columbia Gorge is producing about 35 graduates a year, and the new company that is moving in there needs 400 in 6 months. And this last one is my personal issue. I've spent the last couple of years working around the country on a certificate level program that deals with sort of these middle level production and technician workers. It's focused on those cross-cutting skills in manufacturing that all industries need, and it's sort of the middle skill that's more than high school but not a four-year degree. I'd love to see the community colleges adopt something like that here, because it's a good housekeeping seal of approval. And finally, on the systems end, Oregon's really got to embrace this notion of a talent pipeline. Start using that terminology as opposed to workforce education. It's talent. We need to build the talent pipeline. There are groups that are functional across the state, business-led groups. There are clusters and consortia. Many of them focus as intermediaries that aggregate need and link into the systems, and they're terrific. But they're very fragile, and they need support, and we need to look at how Oregon can continue that the building of groups of businesses working together, because Oregon's a small business state. And finally, this messaging that I spoke to on several occasions. Finally, our conclusion is that there's sort of three possible scenarios. And again, this is very, very broad-based. One is that both the demand side, the businesses, and the supply side sort of continue it's just sort of a passive approach. Slow adoption of innovation on both ends. What ultimately will likely happen is you'll see an increased movement to a service economy, because they will lose the competitive edge that now might exist. The second scenario is that businesses aggressively adopt that competitive strategy, but the supply side doesn't. And then you see this continuing gap where the traded sector companies, because that's their lifeblood, will begin to downsize operations, close, move. And that's a big issue. The third scenario, which is the one we advocate, of course, is shared prosperity, and that's that both the demand side and the supply side become very aggressive and adopt this innovation agenda, which means, of course, some bold action in terms of the systems perspective. And as Claire suggested, shared prosperity means shared responsibility. So this isn't a list of what Claire should do in the next, or Greg should do in the next 6 months or 6 years. This is across business and labor and government and education. You can see even by the recommendations, this is everybody coming together around a common agenda. And within the government side, that cuts across numerous agencies. It's not just the Board of Ed. It's not just the Workforce Board. Again, this is an integrated approach. And finally, the slogan I stole from my work in Maryland. I was assistant secretary responsible for business retention in Maryland for 8 years. And I had a really fun job because we merged economic and employment development. So I had all the workforce pieces, but I also had all the business retention tools. And that was our phrase, jobs for people, people for jobs. But I put it up there because I think it really speaks to one of the recommendations of this very dynamic report, if you're not aware of it, put out by the National Center of Education the economy, saying that, you know, it's really the future is providing the education that's related to the economic drivers of the state, and there are multiple spin-offs within that. So those, in a nutshell, is the summary of this report, which I said will be forthcoming. And Claire, I don't know if you want to make any other comments, or Chair Witt, if there were any questions or discussions from the committee.
Thank you very, very much. Certainly, I think there are a number of policy implications here, and frankly, I think much of what you have said gives us a pause and reason to be concerned about the direction in which our state's economy may be headed if we don't fill the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
Committee members, questions or comments? Yes, Representative Huffman, please.
So great a need, so little time. Just some observations. I think the nursing industry has done a fabulous job the last several years of presenting a need, but along with that advertisement, if you will, they presented potential $25,000 sign-up bonus. I mean, they really dangled the carrot out there, and that was appealing to a lot of people, and particularly adults. Maybe a lot of people that had an associate's degree, or some of my personal friends had no college at all. Mm-hmm. And two in particular that come to mind in the last year have graduated as RNs out of Columbia Gorge Community College. So I think part of the solution is in marketing, letting our possibly ninth graders know that you can make $67 an hour or whatever in a white collar job with a 2-year certificate or something. And I know I've talked to Claire and Greg, and a lot of our emphasis is getting as many of our youth into 4-year college programs as we can. But I visited with them about the need to also stress the trade school or the tech school mm-hmm. aspect of it also for 1-year welding certificates or whatever. One of my questions is, how are we working with ODE? And there is a disconnect apparently between what kids in middle school are not getting as far as advanced math and science and whatnot. Is there a program starting to develop with Department of Education to shore up the educational needs?
Chair Witt, Representative Huffman, I think there are, in the last session, there were a number of really great programs, I think, identified to help fill some of the gap through the education enterprise that went through. I can't speak specifically for the specific areas there. I think probably James Sager, who is the governor's education advisor, might be the person that we might want to bring in to answer that specific question. However, there have been great inroads in a variety of different areas around, particularly around the diploma requirements and having them, and I think you could probably talk a little bit about that. Some of the essential skills are included in the diploma requirements. So there's a lot of discussion, has been a lot of discussion around with the Board of Education around how to help students move a little more quickly and become more job ready. So did you want to say a little something about that?
Yes, please, Chair Witt and Representative Huffman. I really like your health analogy because that's right on target, and they have done an excellent skills across the board. So while it was really focused at nursing, they also talked about technicians and et cetera. So it's a very good model. On the student pipeline end of this, the high school graduate, and yes, certainly the graduation requirements, you know, include additional math and science kinds of things, and that's right on target. Part of the issue, as I mentioned, is time frame. That's 4 years down the road, so that is an issue. I'd also like to sparked something. The pipeline we can't just think of as kids coming out of high school, though, because another very legitimate group is, as you said, you know, either underemployed adults or adults looking for career change. And I was in Medford recently, and you know, some very interesting data there because of their unemployment rate, which is very low. Basically, everybody who wants to work is working, but a very large percentage of sort of that young talent or is in jobs that are $10 an hour or thereabouts, and they're working in the service economy, so they haven't connected yet. So a part of their strategy is, how can we get the message out to people who are already in work but maybe underemployed and looking to shift, change jobs? So there are creative ways to address this, but it does have to be very strategic. Yes?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Follow. And I think we are probably doing a good job in the schools with the new 4-year diploma requirements. I think that's going to set us in the right direction. So education, promotion and marketing, number two. And number three, which I think is the lesser because I think there are a lot of programs out there that the classrooms aren't full yet, that's where the educational marketing part of it comes in, to tell people that, hey, there's a classroom out here you can go to, whether it be a displaced timber worker or whatever, that 25 or 30-something maybe is looking for direction or a career change. But there is that financial component, which I think is probably in third place. It's the lesser of the need, in my opinion. That would be with the Winsmith program that Audrey brought up at Columbia Gorge Community College. Dr. Toda could be training 3 to 4 times as many people. Instead of 35, it could be 105 if he had the money for instructors and classroom space. The demand is there. The need is there. He has not had. He's in his second round of classes for Winsmiths. And I think this current class is now on a. Is it the 2-year program they're in now? The first one was a 1-year certificate, I believe. I believe they're in the 2-year. The industry demand is clearly there, and Dr. Toda's done a good job in the Gorge area or the Mid-Columbia promoting the fact that, hey, this is available, it's open, you can make really good money, you can go straight to work, and he just needs more money in classroom space. And I think that's kind of rare, but that is a situation where more money could do more good.
Yes, Chair Witt, Representative Hoffman, that's exactly on point to the recommendation we made about, you know, the targeting and focusing, because the clean that area is a perfect example of a very clear demand that could be addressed in the short term. This isn't a 4-year issue. This could be dealt with for the resources available immediately.
Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Acknowledge Representative Huffman's analysis there, the demand for money. Last session, as some of you remember, we worked very hard on the Skill Up, that Cam's quite familiar program, and unfortunately it was predicated on raising the corporate minimum tax, which we didn't do. I mean, clearly we need more revenue to put into training. You know, it would be a huge answer to a lot of these problems in getting people educated and trained in some of these skills. But there's another aspect of this that I'd like to focus on, really, and just looking at some of your charts and looking at the replacement openings, for example. One of the issues that I worked on a bit last session was it's not just the training, the skill set, but as those students or those trainees become trained, they need job opportunities. Mm-hmm. And though we see all these looming shortages, oftentimes the shortage isn't quite as extreme right now as it will be 10 years from now. And so we have this huge population or demographic that's going to be retiring or moving on, and it's going to be much more rapid than our training is going to be able to replace. And so somehow we have to have some sort of incentive for employers to have more interns, more apprenticeship openings, so that those trainees can actually take those skills and go to work and start learning through the on-the-job experiences that they need. Because in my experience, the opportunities and for the interns and the apprentices and those that are just entering the workforce are not as large as our demands will be in the future. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a potential for us as a state, you know, across many industries, to look at some way to encourage employers to expand those internships, to expand those on-the-job experiences, to keep the workforce engaged, because we're truly going to need them in the future. And if we don't invest in giving them opportunities now, they're not going to be there in the future. So, I mean, that's a piece of the puzzle that I think we need to solve.
Yes, Chair Witt and Representative Holvey, there's actually, I included in the sort of the very end of the study, I did some work for the National Alliance of Business a few years ago, and there was a a notion that they put out. It was a little bit ahead of its time, perhaps, but you may have heard of it, the knowledge supply chain. Their premise was, you know, many companies, in order to do business, think about their material supply chain. You know, they have to know where they're going to get their goods and their raw materials, and they have that all figured out. But they don't do that. They don't think that way about their knowledge supply chain. Where are they going to get their workers? And so your point is so on target with what they say is it's a culture within companies. Training and investment is always in the cost category, you know, as opposed to an investment category. So there's a cultural shift that needs to happen too. And my experience in this work suggests that the forward-thinking companies get it right away, and they do it in good times and bad.
Yep.
But then you have this whole cadre of folks in the middle who kind of wait and see, and when the pain gets great enough, then they begin to shift gears. There needs to be that same sort of messaging, and that's why they were included in the messaging agenda, is this isn't just about students. It's not just about what counselors need to know. It's also for the business community, and that's where those business consortia and the trade associations and the AOIs of the world and the OBCs of the world come into this conversation, because they need those business organizations to begin to work around this issue of investment and training. And I don't have the number in front of me, but you saw one of the data points on the competitiveness index is that, you know, there is investment in current worker training in Oregon, but it's primarily at the management level, and it's well below national levels. Many business groups now suggest at least 1%. But there's a difference, and my conversations with the folks at the AFL-CIO, I mean, really bring this out, is there's a difference between short-term training for an incumbent worker to address some skill sets that they need, and longer-term strategies, which is really what you're talking about, that whether the ups and downs and that whole apprenticeship notion and the co-op models and the internships. That's why the number three recommendation is we've got to take good models that are already out there and get them to scale. And a part of doing that is on the business side, getting businesses to understand that this is about a grow your own and that it takes those kinds of in-depth partnerships. It's not about 5 hours in the classroom doing your public service and teaching a class or going to a career fair. This is a qualitatively different kind of relationship between the education system and the school system. And again, those states where that is on their radar screen are beginning to see the impact of change, and that's what I'd like to see happen here. And I think the business community is is ready to begin to pony up for more of that.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your presentation. I don't remember which slide it was. Probably about the middle, I think you were talking about educational preparedness. And you mentioned five high schools and one community college that had engaged in a particular process or program. Could you explain that a little bit, and if there's a connection there with OSSI?
With
Oregon Small Schools Initiative, I'm sorry.
Actually, that reference had to do with one particular program model that I referenced, Project Lead the Way. I'm sorry, Chair Witt, Representative Springer. It's a nationally loaned model. And when I was asked by the Workforce Investment Board, you know, with some of this data, well, what does that mean? How do we compare to other states? The way we dealt with it was more little case studies and vignettes to say, by the way, did you know here? And the example for this one was around this particular program that's been so nationally recognized called Project Lead the Way. It's a pre-engineering program, a curriculum. It started in the high schools. It started as a high school initiative. Now they've also done a program for the middle schools. And it's an emphasis, again, to Senator Huffman's point, on the math, the science, the technology application, because you can't say to a high school senior who's not had that kind of exposure, well, why don't you become an engineer? It's something that's ingrained, and so it's project-based learning. They get employers to come in. They get real issues that real companies are dealing with, and the kids actually work with the companies. And so it's very engaging. But because of that, it's labor intensive and expensive. But the results they're showing now, enrollments in engineering programs in states that do this, higher retention in college in the freshman year in pre-engineering and engineering programs is higher. I mean, all the data is there in terms of proven effectiveness. So many states now have said, because it's expensive, we need to deal with this at the state level. And they have earmarked funds or identified sources and said, we'll actually help offset the costs to public schools, which are all struggling. The issue, from my own perspective, based on my background, in part with all of this, and the career tech piece of it in particular, is that there's been such an emphasis on, at the national level, on focusing on math and reading outcome measures and test performance. Somewhere along the line, we got this notion that career tech and applied kinds of things off to the side are extra, like art and science and all of those other and that school systems, when students' math scores were low, tended to do more math classes. Well, for students who don't learn in a traditional environment, that might not be the best way. I do a lot of work with Job Corps. And, you know, the national data suggests that many students learn best in learning theory in an applied environment. So the project Lead the Way is an integral way within the school community to do project-based kinds of learning that focus on math, science, and technology. In Oregon, it's a local school option because there's autonomy in the local schools to make those decisions. So the Oregon Institute of Technology is the university partner for Project Lead the Way in Oregon. And they've been working very closely with ETIC, the Engineering Technology Committee. And they do provide some seed funding to schools who are interested in doing this. And they do provide professional development. And they have trained about 40 teachers. And they're hoping to double. And they're hoping to get 50% of high schools in Oregon into this program over the next few years. And they have a goal to do that. I would love to see the forces that be rally around that and say, okay, businesses, okay, state, okay, everyone, how can we make that happen? That's a very, very appropriate goal. But they're struggling with the scale.
Thank you.
Your question.
Thank you.
Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I think part of the problem, my opinion, and I have lots of them, so stick around. I think a lot of the problem is that parents assume that if Johnny makes it through graduation of high school, that he has a particular skill set that prepares him for the future, whatever that future might be. So I think parents, by and large, think that our kids are getting the education they need. One of the things we're beginning to do in the Dalles in particular is to start educating parents as to the need for them to support more stringent requirements like the new requirements for graduation that are coming about so that they can make that connection with where the problem is. And because I hear both sides of the story. I go out in the community and parents, basically, but residents, taxpayers, they're saying, look at how much this community had to give up, if you will, or invest in getting Google to come to the industrial area. And yet, do you know, they didn't hire hardly any local people. So I go have lunch out at Google and meet with the director, and he says, The workforce here was not prepared. They didn't have the skill sets necessary for us to hire them. Now they employ 200 people, including security and whatnot, which is, you know, at the higher end of what they had anticipated. But so many of that workforce had to be imported. And so trying to educate local people that support new requirements, support your child in education so they will have the skill set. And here again, part of that problem is that we're preparing for 4 or 5 years down the road, but as Representative Holvey pointed out, you know, there's going to be that need 4 to 10 years down the road also.
Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Audrey, for your presentation. It's a well thought out presentation. I'm not sure whether you addressed the issue that when you're talking about the gap. There's a need, the skilled workers, but at the same time, we are not able to provide enough educated skilled workers. So there's a big gap there. The gap is getting bigger and bigger in the future. Mm-hmm. In the now and the future, what realistically, you mentioned more education, more funding, more training. That's, we all know that. But realistically, how are we filling the gap now? And how we are going to fill the gap in the future? That's a real chasm exists in there. Well, could you expound on that issue, please?
Yes, Representative Witt and Vice Chair Lim. I think Representative Hoffman's comment basically answers the question. Unfortunately, in that particular instance, I mean, we see in the Intels of the world, of course, you know, they have had a long history of recruiting their top flight engineers from around the country and around the world. That what I call them that middle skill set, which is what where the resident population should be able to fill and address, that's when it's a sad, really a sad commentary when they can't find workers resident in the state in that skill set. Across the board, you want it to be local because that's where the prosperity comes. You're providing workers for employment in the state, and it's all stays in Oregon. But realistically, we know that companies are going to continue to recruit from outside. When we have to recruit from outside for that middle skill set, it's very telling about the capacity.
And just one comment,
please.
Thank you very much. But at the same time, one of my concerns, when we employ the people from around the world, skilled workers, they come here work, chances are our knowledge of technology is going back to their own country when they go back. That's one of the big things we need to consider. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. has been advanced in technology in the past, but it's not going to be in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we lose that advance, then our economy is not going to be good. In Korea, I'm from Korea. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you all know that. Mm-hmm. We in Korea, they have more educated workforce. And since industry, they are not able to observe all of them. So they want to come over here to work. While the greatest country in the world, mm-hmm. such as the highest that the qualified education system we have, still we are not able to do that. And there are major universities, private and public, many of the engineering schools and occupied good percentage of them from other countries. So Korea is one of them.
Mm.
So I just want to address those issues.
Yes, and Chair Witt and Vice Chair Lim, we actually ran up across that when we looked at the data from the Oregon University system in engineering graduates, was that there's an extraordinarily high percentage of foreign students who come to Oregon because it's a wonderful place to study. There is no data that tracks how many of them stay and how many of them go back to their own country, but general anecdotal information is that quite a few of them go back. So even though we have a pipeline in the engineering programs and they're built up, and we have the statistics and they're in the report about what percentage they're considered alien, it's a big issue, and you raise some excellent points. One of the things we had hoped to do with this study was, again, these are complex issues. And I wish we could all snap our fingers and get all the money and all the change, all the cultures and fix it. But what we had hoped to do was to sort of crystallize and bring together these perspectives of the education system, the economic development drivers, the workforce issues, into a lens around these technology platforms and these big mega categories to help focus what some of the priority actions might be. Because again, if you adopt training programs that address cross-cutting skills that support and feed all of those technology platforms from a public perspective as an investment strategy, that gets you the biggest bang for the buck because it lifts all boats. And it avoids having to pick winners and choosers and say, oh, well, we're going to invest in this and not in that. So from an investment point of view, that was our intention, fully recognizing that there are many differences between and among some of the specialty areas within and among. Thank you.
Representative Witt, Chair and Committee, that's just the challenge we want to take up. The good news is that we have very motivated partners who are willing to collaborate and interested in developing an agenda that would be collectively shared. A lot of the industry trade associations, labor, is very much ready to move forward on things. The state agencies, economic development, education, workforce, are very interested in taking the challenge and moving forward on it. We will be looking at taking the information from this report and from several other reports that we've commissioned, one being with the sustainable clean energy industries, and how we might deal with some of the issues that Audrey was talking about in terms of having a burgeoning expansion in this particular industry with really not enough workers to accommodate that expansion. So we're kind of taking a look at that. And we will be looking at all these and developing an agenda we hope we will have your help doing to perhaps not deal with all the issues quickly, but have an agenda that builds and moves forward in as resources are able to be redeployed and garnered, that we're able to move forward something that a very planful way to deal with some of these issues. So we are planning on taking this and moving forward with it, with your help as well. Thank you.
If we don't take this report up, we don't act on the implications, we will not be the greatest country in the world any longer, Vice Chair Lim. Mm-hmm. Audrey, a couple of questions here.
Yes.
On the current capacity, it's page 7 at the bottom on the handout. You list the occupational trends here, and I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to be looking at this from the supply side or the demand side, and it's important, at least to me, in terms of if I'm looking at solutions out into the future, to know which side is driving what you've written here. In other words, technicians, it appears that we're in equilibrium. Engineering, I'm not sure whether our paucity of engineers is supply or demand side driven.
This is a demand side slide.
Okay.
And you know, one of the challenges of such a, in many ways, kind of a technical report, because there's so much data, is doing a slide presentation. So when you get the report, you'll have the benefit of thinking through the method. You'll see the methodology as it unfolded. But this is a demand side. This is the current capacity in terms of occupational trends. So that point bullet about engineers is that and the growth of engineers, as they are classified by the Employment Department, is at basically been at 4% over the past several years, whereas in the rest of the country, they're putting out and companies are hiring many more engineers. So that also is a clue about the nature of the industry too. And it's hard calibrating all these different pieces, but what that really speaks to and what I would suspect will be happening is you have this traditional industry base with food, for example, and metals and wood, that's a big part of the economy. And in the last few years, those groups have gotten very coalesced around an innovation agenda. I mean, they are beginning to move forward on the innovation front. And what I think is going to be happening now is that there is going to be more, there's going to be a change in the nature of their workforce, too. Things are going to be ratcheting up. They are going to be focusing more on engineering and design and the integration of design across the whole production process. So I think those numbers are likely to change within Oregon as the agenda moves up. And the good news is there's been a lot of work in Oregon around building the capacity on the supply side.
Mm-hmm.
It's making those connections between these more traditional industries. Some of them are there, of course. There's a wood processing innovation center that's doing some great things. But in a practical sense, with the small and mid-sized companies, that's the work that needs to be done, is the reaching out.
Our committee heard a great deal about the challenges that face our workforce during the 2007 session, but you seem to highlight a number of very troubling symptoms here of our inability to first supply an adequate workforce numbers, and secondly, an adequately trained workforce. Much as Representative Huffman just pointed out, a potential to employ a number of people, but the skills weren't there to employ an Oregonian or an Oregon workforce. You yourself pointed out in your presentation the fact that it appears that our state is top-heavy with lower-wage occupations, and I'm challenged by your opportunity and choice. Our whole state is challenged by that, and I like your choice of words, the word choice. That is a decision of which presumably we have control over. We ought to be acting then on, I think, some of the public policy implications that your report raises here. You have very clearly told us that we have an option of becoming a service sector economy. Mm-hmm. Many of those jobs, not all of them, but many of them are, on average, pay a third less than many of our manufacturing traded sector jobs. You've said that we have another option, which is to essentially outsource our state's economy. I would choose neither of those paths. Or we could have shared prosperity. Now, in terms of the pipeline, what our committee looked at during the 2007 session, our empty pipeline, the fact that it's empty is probably not a whole lot different than most other states in our nation. But what troubles me greatly, it seems to be, and I think your presentation was suggesting that we are laggards in terms of being able to develop the necessary infrastructure to be able to accommodate the pipeline. And I would I just ask for your comments on that.
Chairman. I thought long and hard about those three scenarios and putting them forward, but I've spent the last 4 months, you know, getting my head around all of this. And because I do a lot of work nationally, I do have the opportunity to make, although informal and perhaps subjective, comparisons between and among other states. And, you know, I have been concerned about some of the trends I see in Oregon, particularly over the past decade, the lack of investment in the human capital agenda, and for a variety of reasons. And as you know much better than I, the financing structure of the state and the dilemmas that presents. I guess one comment I would make is I don't think of the pipeline as empty per se. There are a lot of people, there are many people available for work.
Mm-hmm.
I like to have the conversation about skills, because if I go back to Representative Huffman's point, it probably wasn't that there weren't people, bodies available, it's that there was a skills gap between what the people available for work and the needs of the employers. So That's not true in every area of the state, and I think the example I gave in Medford is a good one because their unemployment rate is so low. But, I mean, having said that in very general terms, in large measure, some of this is a skills gap issue. And so it's about how do we create those career pathways to take people at very low functional levels and move them up, and then take that group and move it up, and take that group and move it up, so that you've got a framework within the state where there are stepping stones and systems that support those stepping stones. That's the pipe. That to me is the whole pipeline, is taking people who are available for work and getting them in, and then creating systems to continue through lifelong learning to build their skill sets and build the whole spectrum of the workforce. And that's why it is a big agenda, and that's why it involves the Board of Education and the Board of Higher Education and the workforce. This is everybody's issue. And the states that have begun to really address this, they use their economic development framework, and that's why we posited these seven drivers, future drivers, as a way to begin to organize and think about how to help the supply side focus their efforts. And what you begin to see are career pathways that are very clearly lined out and very clearly communicated to the general public about, well, if you are really interested in this area, these are the kinds of jobs, these are the kinds of wages, this is the kind of skills you need, here's where you go to get those skills, and the support system through the right financing setup that provides not only the opportunity for the institutions to do it, but for the individuals to do it. And one of the benchmark studies in our project that you will see is, for example, I did a little vignette on the Georgia, it's called the Hope Scholarship. It's their version of the Opportunity Program. And most states have one. But what they've done in Georgia, is they've found the resources within the state to supplement their program, allows every resident, and it's particularly focused on those who are employed, to go back to the Georgia Community College system, where they have had for 10 years that cross-cutting certificate that I talked about, free of charge. The equivalent of 2 years of post-secondary, whenever and wherever they want to take it over the course of their lifetime. That's innovative. And I have to say, I'm not an expert on that, but that's what we found. Mm-hmm. And what's happening then is that employers are, and particularly in some of the traditional industries, to motivate their workers to do that, are saying, if you go back and you make that investment on your own time, I mean, it's free, but they still have to spend the time, we'll raise your wages an hour, a dollar an hour. Or some, you know, there are companies that are beginning to think in those terms. And they've linked it in with the apprenticeship system so that it's not separate, so that the community college training counts as the related instruction, so somebody can graduate and get an AA degree and also their machinist certification, all that good stuff. Where, and Oregon, you know, has focus their opportunity grant program on, it's a needs-based program, which is very legitimate, but you get the sense of contrast between approaches. And again, that's just one example to speak to choices. And I like to use the word opportunity, too, because Oregon is so well positioned and you've got such dedicated people working. I mean, I am just blown away. Oregon, it just blows me away in terms of the dedication, the models. And in many ways, despite some of the profile of the industry, been able to hold and maintain this competitive position. That bubble chart I showed you, I mean, that's a good bubble chart. You just have to think, though, at some point, there's going to be, we're coming to that point where, I mean, where are the bubbles going to go? They're not going to stay in that top right-hand corner. They're going to start shifting for all the reasons we've already talked about this morning. And that's the urgency here. That's the urgency of the discussion.
Well, in a competitive world, if you're not always on the cutting edge, then your competition will eat your lunch. And I'm concerned that we are not motivated to remain on that cutting edge. Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last example you gave is something that I would love to do. Where did they find the money?
You know, I went online and looked as much as I could, and I know it's state funds, but I will personally take responsibility for asking that, finding the answer to that question. I don't have it today, but I'll do some more digging. It wasn't very straightforward on the public information sources that I explored. Okay. But I will dig on that. There are other states. Michigan just launched a very similar thing. It's a Michigan Guaranteed Opportunity Program or something, and it's by 2014 that they want to have 20,000 workers go back to get continued education, no charge.
Audrey, you just talked about the importance of education. Our committee is going to meet jointly tomorrow night with the Education Committee. During the 2007 session, repeatedly, we discussed workforce needs, and time again, it went back to the education system. And I'm just wondering if you have some recommendations in terms of considerations that we ought to be thinking about in terms of our education system, the way in which we educate people, our expectations of the people that we're educating, the models that we use for education. Do you any suggestions in those areas?
Sure, Whit, that's a big one.
It is.
That's a big one. I made a similar presentation to the Board of Education, and it was a very provocative discussion. And there was the same, you know, sort of somber is not quite the right word, but compelling discussion about change. I think the dilemma has been, and I've been involved with a number of states who have ratcheted up high school graduation requirements and dealt with that issue many years ago. So my evaluation would suggest that catch-up is a phrase that comes to mind. Oregon's in a sort of a catch-up mode.
Yes.
When you compare the general approach, things are on everybody's radar screen, but again, the will, the movement to action, it's all in the right direction. It's just slower and not as bold.
Yes.
And times require bold action. These times require bold action. That was the purpose of the first quote. You know, if a state's a lemming, you know, they're just going to follow the crowd. It is a choice, and they aren't easy choices. They're tough choices. But it requires this coalescing of forces coming together, and that was sort of my approach to this study and to my charge, was create an agenda that's compelling, that does cut across. Clearly, the primary role of any public education system is to prepare future citizens, future workforce. And what a lot of the national studies suggest is that the key issue now is willingness to learn, agility, so that because of this lifelong learning agenda, that you get past this mentality that, oh, high school is that's the benchmark. Just graduate from high school and then you're good to go. The message has to change. The public K-12 system is to lay the foundation for the ability to learn, the willingness to learn, the interest to learn, the movement towards innovation and creative. How else can we do this? In my previous life as an educator, I was had the good fortune to work with gifted and talented kids, okay? And I did that, I mean, I've been on both ends, special needs, regular classroom, gifted and talented. And I was so struck with the fact that I was trained to use things like divergent teaching, divergent questions. So when you're in a classroom, you're no longer asking for what's the right answer. You know, give me the facts, memorize. It's much more, how many ways can we do this? What's another way to think about this? It's divergent. There is often no one right answer. But those training techniques that I got for gifted and talented, guess what? That's what all teachers need to learn to do, because all kids have talent. They just have to be motivated and challenged. So a huge issue is professional development.
Which is right, really, where I was headed, because when I asked you earlier about, in your presentation, about the skills, both workplace as well as personal management,
yes.
I asked you if it was being
ordered.
I'm not sure that a Tayloristic approach to education serves the acquirer of skills such as creativity, innovation, critical thinking, problem solving, etc. That's a new type of skill set that may beg for a different kind of educational system.
Sure, wait. I mean, you're singing my song now, because that's basically where I spend about half of my professional time on the career technology side of the world, on creating new systems for educating for the 21st century workplace. And you're absolutely right. Some of the models that are out there that have been highly effective is, and you've probably heard about, you know, the academy models and the smaller learning communities, where they tap into an interest fairly early in the high school. It's not that they're tracked into a particular career, but they're motivated because they're interested in a science technology career academy versus a international academy versus a engineering technology academy. And they use the business partnerships and the teaching methods, and it's much more applied. It's all contextual. So it's math in the context of solving real problems. And that tends to motivate all students, because we know from learning theory that that is the way kids tend to relate, is through something they're interested in, whether it's photography or cooking. Just you apply the math skills, you apply the reading in that context. And so there's data now to suggest that this sort of model that organizes into smaller learning communities and career academies, that are oftentimes, one of the things we did in Maryland was we aligned the public school system's curriculum framework to the six driving economic sectors, and so that at the high school level, the kids were exposed to all of it, and then they spent their junior and senior year in the area that was most connected to their interest. And then there were strong connections between what they did in the secondary and the community college. It was a 2+2+2. Environmental technology is a very brief example, if you're interested. And biotech. Let me do the biotech one, because when I was in Maryland, the economy there was very much like Oregon's several years ago. We were strong in defense. We were a very monolithic kind of state. 61 federal laboratories and many, many suppliers that oriented around the big manufacturers, AAI and defense. And when that bottom fell out, I mean, unemployment in many of the parts of the state was 24-25%. And I was head of the job training system at the time, and, you know, that all fell on me, and it was huge. So when when we merged with economic development, the thing was, how do you then begin to take the growth, potential growth areas inherent in the state, and create an agenda to feed and support those? So we went through very similar sort of analysis, and, you know, in the interest of full divulging, the person from Battelle who worked on this report with me was the head of our Office of Technology Development in Maryland at the time, which is how I knew him. And so we were charged with working with lots of business groups to coalesce around this agenda. We produced very similar kinds of reports. That was 12 years ago. And the upshot on the education side was, okay, out of all the research coming out of the University of Maryland and Johns Hopkins, all the biotech research, the environmental technology research, et cetera, I'll just use those two, what are we doing? Because it was at the fledgling stages. What are we doing to build the capacity on the education side? So the Secretary of Economic Development was charged with convening. And I will never forget this meeting. It was so compelling. The supply side folks around the biotech agenda. So in the room with the head of economic development charged by the governor, there were the presidents of the, in, it was in that case the Baltimore area community colleges, all the universities. And he literally said, we want to build a talent pipeline for biotech. Tell me what you're doing for biotech now and what you could do for that. And literally went around the room. About halfway around, I remember the chancellor of the university system saying, you know, this is the first time we've ever all gotten together to talk about this, because there is no forum for us to talk about collaborative. I didn't even know you were doing this, he says, you know, et cetera. And so we left that meeting with the development, an agreement to develop a human pipeline plan to feed the biotechnology industry. And out of that came magnet schools that were identified at the high school level, specific community college programs at the level, feeding in and connecting to new university programs, et cetera. And then that was held up so that everybody could understand what that meant. And the other part of it was investment of the state in that particular area in a facility that was actually around taking the small little bits of stuff that companies produce for trial, which was all going to New Jersey at the time, to be manufactured in small batches so they could then pass the FDA trials. So once they passed the FDA trials, guess where all the manufacturing was happening? New Jersey. And they were all being bought up and sold off. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of the jobs were. So you had this high-profile science and tech piece doing the R&D. We had the capacity on the system now gained. What we needed was the manufacturer, the pharmaceutical companies. So then the economic development folks went to work. We had to, we put like $10 million into what's called a bioprocessing scale-up facility where they could actually do the trials at Johns Hopkins. I mean, it's like a no-brainer, but you have to get all the pieces of the puzzle aligned. And so we did that, and then they could scale up there. And then we worked with the rural parts of the state that were up the 270 corridor to find good land for the manufacturing. And then Johns Hopkins put a university campus on the east side of the state where they'd never had it. So you see how the whole piece had to come together. And if you drive up from Washington now up the 270 corridor, you see nothing but biotech kinds of things and research and all of the interrelated pieces. That's how you build a sector. And that's the stuff that Michael Porter's talking about, is the specialization on the education side. So people want to be there. They want to be there. And that's the opportunity that exists here in Oregon, is to stand back and have a strategic, thoughtful plan to say, what are we going to do? How are we going to do it? And this was our first attempt. It's not as heavy on the economic development side. We use that as a framework. This was more on the supply side. But that's the opportunity, is to take those kinds of resources and approach more than resources, because those examples are clear. It's a business agenda. It's a labor agenda. It's a public school agenda, university agenda. It's all got to come together. And it doesn't happen overnight. It's a 15-year process. Mm-hmm. But 10 or 15 years from now, that's where I'd love to see Oregon. So it has to begin.
It must begin, or as to Representative Lynn's point, our competition will outdo us. In his example, a relatively small country such as Korea, turning out vastly better prepared students, perhaps, than we have available here in the United States. That's a wake-up call. Business Week labeling the next century not the next year, not the next decade, the entire century, the century of China and India, is a wake-up call. If it isn't a wake-up call, then we've lost it. And your report is a wake-up call for the state of Oregon, because we will either do it here or our competition will do it somewhere else. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your presentation. Very quickly, I've had a request for a couple of other people perhaps to say a couple of words. Jim, did you want to follow up on the education piece? Okay, a little later time. Mike Sullivan, you wanted to say a couple of words, did you? And was there anyone else in the audience that that wished to say a couple of words? Audrey, thank you so very, very much.
Good morning, Chairman Witt and committee. My name is Mike Sullivan, and I'll get it right this time. I'm the political director of the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, and I just want to make a few remarks about the real deal is location, 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 accessibility, and cost of education. And to Representative Riley's question about Georgia, what I know of from the Labor Party is they did an experiment on the Labor Party's free higher education for all, which was modeled after the GI Bill of World War II, that put for every dollar of the Treasury, of the Federal Treasury, it put back in $6.90. But when they made that accessible, a program like that in Georgia, to all citizens, it basically bankrupted. So the real deal, I think, on that is that it has to come as a federal act rather than states can't afford it on the individual. If you take the argument of a GI Bill state by state, there wouldn't be much of a benefit. But back to the issue that we're talking about, and I just want to give some perspective of my own personal experience at my former employer, Cascade Steel in McMinnville, Oregon. Back in the early 90s, the Labor and Research Center of the University of Oregon had a Workforce 2000 committee, which I served on, and they talked about partnerships in the workforce for education and development of jobs in the 2000s. I know the Chair Witt is very aware of that. We asked the LURC team to come into Cascade Steel with the blessing of our employer, and the CEO's name was Mark Michelson. And basically the idea was embraced, and we had on-site education. They hired an educator who visited the workers on-site and asked them, surveyed them, what would they like to see, what would be important to them. And my trade is roll turning. It's much like machinist. And roll turners have gone by the by like tool and die with computer. And what we were coming up with was almost $1 million machineries on this, but none of us had any expertise in computer. So one of the classes they offered was computer familiarization. And a fellow worker of mine was close to 60 then. He was scared to death of computers. And this instructor disarmed immediately and a lot of other people in the room when he said, computers are stupid. They can only count zeros and ones. And it made this old worker, who was a skilled tradesman, a very good, competent, computer-skilled, trained tradesman, but you never would have thought it. And in fact, the German technicians who came in to teach us on this machinery, one of them told me, John, he's too old. But then you have to understand the history of Germany after World War II. Their workforce was so, gone, that they only did, and they did apprenticeships on all things. There were no old people left. They didn't think it was a good investment. But in my trade, too, I was hired to come from another state to work here because Cascade Steel is the only rolling mill in Oregon. So as I worked, I realized we didn't want to keep bringing people in from somewhere else when there were people. So my former myself went to the company, and eventually we got an apprenticeship program. They'd already had electrician and millwright. But from that, we got mobile maintenance in there and a couple other trades. And then we trained seven or eight roll turners ourselves that were in the plant that had the capabilities and went through the program, and they lived here all their life. They didn't come as a transplant like myself. Back to this on-site education, the other classes that were taught, like computer skills, were basic study habits, math, array of college classes. In fact, I got 12 college credits that helped me eventually get a four-year degree. So it works. The company got angry, I think, after a time because they started losing people. They lost what the message was in the beginning from Mort Michelson when he began it. He said, I don't care if they leave. I want the best and most educated workforce. It was a sacrifice on their part, but a good example of what can be done. And back to Germany, I know in the steel industry, they train their journeymen, and then they're free to go anywhere within the country because they want to return that back to their country. There's a lot of burden on businesses, I know, but there's a lot of burden on workers to stay in a company. So it's a mutual investment. It can work, and it worked at Cascade Steel. So I just wanted to share the experience that I've gone through, and it was a big benefit to me and other people. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Questions or comments? It has the appearance that your coworkers, your company, your employer, all benefited from work-based learning in this instance. Would you care to comment briefly on why doing it in the workplace maybe worked better than doing it in the classroom?
Very good question, Chair Witt. The problem was the accessibility of education. Personally, I worked 50 and 60 hours for 25 years here in Oregon. Other people work 12-hour shifts. It's very hard to get into the traditional college education grind. So what they did is they made particularly the computer skills room open 24 hours a day, open so people could practice and see how the thing worked. But they had educational classes up till 8 p.m. every night. But like I said, they got a bit angry and they did away with it because they were losing people. But it was a very good program.
Just a commentary on the need for highly educated, highly skilled people. They're mobile.
Yes.
further discussion? I'm seeing none. Mike, thank you very, very
thank
much.
Thank you very much.
Committee members, before we adjourn, Patrick handed out a list of items that came out of our January 14th hearing. The first page is simply a list of issues that we discussed. More importantly, and more to the point of what I'm asking you to consider, would be the second page, which is taken from the first, and those items which with a first cut, we thought should be our committee should recommend be sent to Representative Boone's Emergency Preparedness Committee. And what I would like you to do is take a look at these, consider that, see if there's anything else that we should add or delete or otherwise modify from this list, and we will revisit this here at a later meeting. Anything further to come before our committee? Patrick, would you remind us what our meeting schedule is here in the remainder of the week?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tomorrow night at 6:30 in Hearing Room F, we will be joining the House Education Committee for another briefing on workforce issues. The Education Committee has a couple of people from national level to come that are coming from out of state to speak to their committee and invited our committee to join them on that. So that will be in Hearing Room F. Thursday, it's looking like at this point we're going to be preempted by, at least potentially at this point, by House floor session, which will start in the morning. We may be able to work around that, but that at this point we'll need to wait until tomorrow to find out what the calendar looks like. And Friday, I'm working to put together some agency briefings.
Thank you very much. Anything else?
Yeah,
no. Yes.
Could you explain to us again that when is our last hearing will be, and the Senate bills and House bills, do you know? Yeah.
I believe the date, Vice Chair Lim, for us to begin on Senate bills is 1 week.
We have until the 21st.
Until the 21st. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And at this point, I'm unaware of any Senate bills having come over to our committee.
I'm unaware either. Have not received message on that. Anything further? With that, thank you very much, witnesses. Thank you very much, committee members. We will stand adjourned until further notice.